But pretty much as soon as these things were in operation, they started seeing weird signals on them that were not planes. Like planes, they kind of plod along at a consistent speed and trajectory. And they started seeing these other weird things that would appear and disappear and change speed and change direction at random. And they couldn't figure out what they were looking at. This might be apocryphal, but supposedly at one point they even like urgently scrambled fighter planes into the air to go intercept strange signals over the English Channel, got out there and there was nothing there. And so the radar operators started calling these things radar angels because they just couldn't figure out what they were. And of course, because we're talking about bird migration, where this is going is that they were actually birds.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Bethany Brookshire. Did you notice how during lockdown, everyone began to notice the birds? There we were, all stuck in our houses. And for the first time, many people in the suburbs began to realize just how many birds there are in the world. It's a lot of birds. And now I can't even sit at my desk in the morning without paying attention to the actual cacophony of birds that is going on outside my window. And part of this kind of bird awareness was just a bunch of humans actually paying attention for the first time. But another big part of it is that the 2020 COVID lockdowns took place largely during the spring migration, when millions upon millions of birds were in transit, some of them eventually heading the length of entire oceans or across whole continents. Why on earth do birds do this? Why do they change locations? And why do they often go so far? What do scientists even know about where birds go? To find out, I'm here with Rebecca Heisman, a professional bird writer and author of the new book, Flight Paths, How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solved the Mystery of Bird Migration. Rebecca, thank you so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Now, I wanted to start by asking, you are obviously a bird person, yes. And there are a lot of bird people in this world. What made you specifically want to focus on bird migration as opposed to bird other behavior or plumage? Or, you know, birds have things that they do other than migrate. What made you want to focus on migration?
I mean, I think I had been thinking for a while as a writer and a bird person that it would be fun to eventually write a popular science book about birds in some way. And there's already been a lot of really good popular science books written about various aspects of birds. So I knew I would have to think of something different. And before the pandemic, I was working for the American Ornithological Society, which is the big professional society for bird scientists. They give out research grants and put on conferences and things like that. I was their one-person communications department. And so I was reading a lot of scientific papers. They published two peer-reviewed journals, and working on promoting those papers by writing press releases and blog posts and stuff. And I kept getting sucked into and fascinated by the method sections of the papers where the scientists explained how they did what they did. And I might have learned about some of this as an undergraduate and forgotten, but I either didn't know or had forgotten that you could study bird migration using weather radar, and you could study it by putting out microphones to passively record the sounds of birds passing overhead. And you could study it by analyzing weird hydrogen isotopes in bird feathers. And I thought all that was really cool and wondered, how does it work and who figured that out? And so when I left that job at the start of the COVID pandemic, that's what eventually turned into this book proposal.
Yeah, the method sections are hands down always the best part of scientific papers.
Yes.
Because that's where you get down into the nitty gritty of, you know, the voltammetry rig was stabilized by an equal distribution of force on tennis balls that were held inside rolls of duct tape, which is actually how that happened in my laboratory.
Yes, there's a lot of hidden gems in method sections.
So good. So I wanted to ask, can we start with a definition of what it is to migrate?
I mean, basically, it's just when birds make predictable movements back and forth across some part of the planet between seasons.
Okay, so it has to be predictable. It has to happen every year, at least.
There's probably different definitions floating around out there. But when we're talking about birds, birds can be sedentary, where they stay in the same place all year, or they can be migratory, where they're making these seasonal movements, or they can be nomadic, where they're just sort of wandering around at random looking for food, but there's no real pattern to it. Or they can also be what's called eruptive, which is where they don't make big movements every year, but like every few years, depending on environmental conditions, there might be a big movement south or something. So there's a lot of different movement patterns that you can see with bird species and within bird species. There are bird species where some of them migrate and some of them don't. So it can be pretty complicated.
Yeah. And eruptions, bird eruptions, which is IRR eruptions, not ERU yes. eruptions.
Yes. Thank you.
Make me think of snowy owls because they're the ones who really do that. And they tend to show up in like cities or around airports. And everyone's like, there's this giant owl.
Yeah. Those are the ones that non-birders notice probably the most. But there's also a lot of boreal finches like evening grosbeaks and pine grosbeaks. And those guys that also have these eruptive movements. And so birders will get really excited when it's an eruption year for winter finches.
And I was wondering, do we know what proportion of bird species migrate? Like, is it like a third? Is it like a tenth? Is it something that most of them do or half? Like, do we have any idea?
You know, that's a really good question. And probably someone knows, but I do not know the answer off the top of my head.
That is a reasonable response. And I wanted to also ask, you know, when we think about migration, we think of like the big ones, like there are tiny birds that migrate across the whole Gulf of Mexico and their tiny little wings literally do not stop beating for three straight days.
Mm-hmm. And hummingbirds do that.
Every time I see a hummingbird now, I'm like, you are amazing. You're an ultra marathoner of birds. You're so small. Or, you know, there's that famous bird E7 that flew all the way across the Pacific Ocean.
Yes.
And there are also migrations where birds will kind of like roll through an area, right? So not all of them are this like extreme, you know, we're going to go across the Himalayas. We're going to go across the Pacific Ocean. There are also kind of bird migrations that are land-based. And I was wondering, what does that kind of look like? This kind of like, is it like hopping? Or, you know, how does the kind of land-based migration look as compared to the big epic ones?
Well, yeah. So you've got your long distance migrants, which are the ones that are making these journeys, you know, from one continent to another and back. And then you've got short distance migrants, which is what we might call like a bird that moves from the northern part of the contiguous 48 U.S. states to the southern part and back each year or something like that. And so, yeah, they're not crossing any giant bodies of water. You've also got altitudinal migrants, which are just like moving from a mountain down into a valley and back over the course of a year. And then, so that answers part of your question. And then I think you're also asking about like the pace of migration.
Yeah.
And that does vary a lot too. There are birds that are like, all right, here I go, boom. And you know, like a week later, they're on another continent. And then there are other birds that have a different strategy and move much more slowly. Like I have a friend who studies rails, which are these weird secretive marsh birds. They look a little bit like ducks, but they're not ducks. Oh, and if you've ever heard the phrase thin as a rail, it's not talking about railroads. It's talking about rails, the birds, because they're really skinny to fit through marshes. But anyway,
I did not know that.
I just blew your mind. Yes. Anyway, rails, it turns out, like, have a really lazy migration where they'll come to what's called like a stopover area, which is like a place where you stop and rest on migration. And they might hang out there for like a month before going on and finishing their migration. So there's as many different migratory strategies as there are migratory birds, really.
So if thin as a rail refers to an actual like bird, does the bird. Crazy old coot also refer to a coot like the bird?
Very possibly.
Oh my goodness.
I don't know that one.
I wanted to ask, I wondered as I read your book, what do we know about how migration evolves? It's not like a bird is hatched one day in New Jersey and like the fall arrives and the bird is like, I have a sudden urge to be in Brazil. Like it has to presumably evolve over time. Do we know or have an idea of what that process looks like?
We have some guesses. So obviously, migratory birds are all descended from birds that were not originally migratory. And so the question is, how did we get from a bird that doesn't migrate to a bird that flies across the Pacific Ocean every year? Probably they started out making obviously much shorter distance movements seasonally, like following food resources. And then, you know how natural selection works. If the birds that made these little short movements around to follow food resources had more babies, then those babies might, you know, keep doing that and might start making longer movements. And so over time, you get longer and longer distance migrants. There's some theories that the ice age glaciation might have played into this, like birds might have been breeding further north, and then the glaciers came down and pushed them south. And then when the glaciers receded, they started, you know, making flights back up to visit where they had lived before. And that might have helped migration get going. At least with the migrants between North America and South America, there's kind of two different hypotheses to explain where they might have started out from. There's either the northern home hypothesis, which is the idea that today's migrants are descended from birds that evolved at northern latitudes and then started to push further and further southward in the winter to try and get away from winter weather. And then there's the southern home hypothesis, which is the idea that migrants started out as tropical birds moving north looking for better breeding grounds. And if you look at the family tree of long-distance migrants in the Americas, it looks like that northern home hypothesis was probably more likely, where migrants today are descended from birds that started out in the north and then went further south to avoid harsh winters.
This makes sense to me.
Yeah, we don't really know for sure. There's a lot of guesswork.
The northern home makes sense to me because who doesn't love a beach vacation? Like, of course you want to go south. Like that. Yeah. That is normal.
And yeah, again, those might even have been birds that were pushed south for a while by glaciers and then started going further north again when they could and going back and forth. So,
and I was wondering, what do we know about the biology of migration? So we know, for example, that they're going to like tank up on food. They're going to like get as many calories as they possibly can before they start doing this stuff. And they're going to try and get calories during some of them. But I was also wondering, do we know hormonally, neurologically, like what takes place between the day the bird is sitting in the woods and the day the bird is like, I'm off, I'm out.
So with the big caveat that I'm not really a hormone or physiology person, I can try to address some of this. First of all, yeah, they do tank up with like lots of body fat. Like they try to put on as much body fat as they can because that's like their, you know, gasoline that's going to fuel them as they're making these long distance flights. They also, any organ system that they might not need while they're migrating, like shrinks away to nothing. Like they basically just reconfigure the entire inside of their body. Yeah. Anything that they're like,
that's
any,
really cool.
Well, I mean, you know, like the reproductive organs of birds, like they basically grow them during during reproduction season. And then they shrink back down to nothing when they don't need them. So yeah, if they're not going to be eating a lot on migration, maybe, you know, their digestive system shrinks away to nothing to save weight. So yeah, they basically go through this giant physiological transformation. And then, yeah, I think that so there's this great German word for migratory restlessness. It's Zugunruhe. It literally just means movement restlessness, but it's a really great German word. And so you can see this even in captive birds that when migration time rolls around, they get really restless and they start fluttering against the sides of their cage. And so they're clearly, I think you're right that it's hormones. I'm not a hormone expert, but yeah, there's something like hormonally driven, like something going on in their brain that's causing them to be like, okay, like it's time to go, it's time to go, it's time to go. And even if they're in a cage, you can see that behavior.
And I was also wondering, what do we know about how they navigate? You know, they're always going back to the same spot. Are they like smelling it out?
Yeah. So some birds actually do have a really good sense of smell. I feel like we're all told that that's not the case. But there are like seabirds, this is getting a little bit away from migration, but I mean, seabirds make very long distance movements around the oceans, and they are largely navigating by smell. So there are birds that have a really good sense of smell and can do that. Most of our like long distance migratory songbirds are probably not relying on their sense of smell, but they have a lot of other stuff. I think there is evidence that to some degree they can recognize, you know, landmarks on the earth below them, like river systems and stuff. They also can navigate using the position of the stars overhead. And there were some really cool experiments done decades ago where they would put a bird experiencing Zugunruhe under a planetarium so that they could rotate the appearance of the night sky above it. And sure enough, it's the direction it was trying to flutter in changed as they rotated the night sky. So it was orienting itself using the stars. They can also orient themselves using the position of the sun at sunrise and sunset. And a lot of people know this, but it's so cool. Birds can actually sense the Earth's magnetic field, so they can navigate using an internal magnetic compass. Ornithologists have been trying to figure out for a while exactly how they do that. Like, they have concrete evidence that this is happening, but they don't know exactly how. For a while, they thought that they might have like magnetic particles in their beaks. The leading theory now has to do with quantum physics. It's that they have like blue light. So I'm not a quantum physicist, but it's like they have special weird blue light sensitive particles in their eyeballs that like can get excited into one of two different quantum states depending on what's going on with the Earth's magnetic field, and then they can quantum physics in their eyeballs somehow helps them like see the Earth's magnetic field. It's really weird.
That is amazing. Also, yeah. I've decided that Zugunruhe is the name of my first emo folk album.
Like, yes,
Great. It's a great name. So I also wanted to ask, you know, you talked about when these birds get ready to migrate, they tank up, they get real chubby, and they shrink the organs that don't matter. And some of these birds are going thousands of miles. These are incredible feats of athleticism.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, do we know if it has an effect on the bird's health and like how long it lives? Are there ultra marathoners that marathoning birds that live longer than birds who stay home? Is there a trade-off in the other way that like the birds don't live as long, but they end up, you know, getting better food while they're living? Like, what do we know about that?
Yeah. So this is where you emailed me before we talked and we're like, I want to talk about whether migrating birds don't live as long. And I was like, wait, do they not live as long? And then I was Googling this so that I can answer intelligently. We do know that migration is a really dangerous time of year for birds. So mortality on migration is high. If you're a migratory bird, chances are that you're going to die during migration rather than during breeding season or during winter season. As far as whether migrating birds have shorter lifespans overall, there's a lot of different factors that play into the lifespan of any one bird species. So I think it's a little hard to get at that in a really clear way, just because there's so many different migrating birds with so many different, you know, they come in all shapes and sizes and they have all sorts of different diets and everything. I think there is some evidence that if you can control for all of those things overall, migratory species do have a faster pace of life overall, which includes having more babies and dying younger. So yeah, migration is dangerous. The reason that they do it is even though it is dangerous, is because the trade-off makes it worth it of being able to follow these pulses of resources in different parts of the globe. So like a lot of birds migrate up to the Arctic to have their babies. You wouldn't necessarily want to be a little songbird hanging out in the Arctic during the winter, but the Arctic spring, even though it is short, it is like flush with so many insects. So it actually can work out really well to fly up to the Arctic so that you can feed your babies on this giant glut of insects and then just fly out again a few weeks later when that's over. And some of these birds that migrate to the Arctic, they do just spend a few weeks there and then turn around and head south again. It's pretty amazing. Yeah.
That is wild. Yeah. So most of your book focuses on how scientists know where birds go. And I love that Aristotle thought swallows didn't migrate. They just hid in small holes in trees all winter and just people didn't see them.
That idea persisted a long time. There were other people later who picked it up and were like, maybe they're hibernating in the mud at the bottoms of lakes.
That was hilarious. And
this was apparently like a folk idea that people believed up until like the 18th and 19th centuries, that swallows were hibernating in mud at the bottoms of ponds. Like that idea that kind of started with Aristotle being like, maybe they're hibernating, like persisted for a weirdly long time.
And I do get it because, you know, there are plenty of mammals and that hibernate, and there are plenty of reptiles and amphibians that go torpid. Like that's actually not unreasonable.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, how often have you seen a swallow completely covered in mud?
Yes, good point.
Because that would be a necessary life stage, right? They'd have to come out and they'd have to be completely disgusting. And you've never seen it. So my favorite was the dude who was like, oh yeah, no, birds do totally migrate to spend the winter. They just spend the winter on the moon.
Yes, I know. That's my favorite too. It's so wild. This was this guy. Oh gosh, what was his name? Charles Morton. He was an English minister and educator, and he was around in the 1600s. And he wrote this whole long essay about his theory of bird migration, which was that he thought the birds flew to the moon and back.
And some of them may fly very, very far, but not quite to the moon.
Yeah, I mean, he overestimated how fast birds could fly, and he underestimated how far it was to the moon. And in general, people at that point weren't really aware of the lack of oxygen between planets. He did, though, you know how we were talking about how birds tank up with body fat? He did actually write in there about how maybe they're putting on lots of body fat to fuel their journey to the moon. So he kind of hit upon a couple of realities of bird migration. He just had the destination wrong.
I did love, however, that there are some indigenous people that have known about migration. So you mentioned, for example, that Athabascan people actually had a story about animals migrating.
Yeah, and I wasn't able to do a really deep dive into stories about bird movements and migration from indigenous cultures around the world. I'm sure there are a lot of them. But yeah, I did stumble across this one from the Athabascan people in Alaska. They had a story that basically a raven, which is a bird that stays in Alaska year round, fell in love with a goose. And then it was very sad in the fall when the goose left and flew south and the raven wasn't able to follow it and keep up with it and had to stay behind. And so Raven was sad that he couldn't stay with his wife, the goose.
That's very sad.
Yeah.
So you also talk about kind of the history of like how scientists have studied bird migration. And that includes putting bands on birds, usually little leg bands. And I was especially struck by how few of the birds that get banded ever get seen again. Like for ducks, it's like 1 in 10 are seen again. And for songbirds, it's like 1 in 400. And yeah. I was wondering why so few? Are we just really bad at re-catching birds? Are their lives that hard?
I mean, there's just a lot of birds out there, and the chances that any one of them is going to blunder into a net or die somewhere where it might be picked up by someone who will see that it has a leg band is just not large. So yeah, this is one of the oldest ways of studying migration, but it's still really important today. They still do it. They take these metal bracelets and each one's individually numbered so that if you ever see that bird again, you can look up its number and see where it was banded. And yeah, they catch them and they collect a lot of data on them and put these little bracelets on them and let them go. And if they are recaptured, or if they, again, sometimes they just turn up dead and you're like, oh, this bird's got a band on it, then we get some good data that way. You're right that the percentage of recaptures is super small, but actually we get a lot of really good data from bird banding even without birds needing to be recaptured, because it's this really long-term data set. They've been doing it since the early 20th century. And the way it works is they have what are called like bird observatories that are just operating every spring and fall, catching all the birds that they can that are going through that area. And for every bird that they catch, in addition to putting a band on it, they're recording like the species and the sex and the age as far as they can figure it out and the weight and all this stuff. And so you get like this record over time of like on what dates were what species passing through what areas. And this is the sort of thing that's let us see like how spring migration is shifting earlier due to climate change. So that comes from bird banding data, but it like, or data from bird banding stations, but it doesn't actually require those birds to be recaptured. I'm sorry if that got away a little bit from your question.
No, that's really useful.
Yeah. So like with bird banding, like the recaptures are part of it, but also just the long-term records from banding stations are also part of it.
So I also, there is a legend, something of a legend, that John James Audubon invented bird banding. And Audubon is now controversial because he was racist. But
he was awful.
Did he invent bird banding and successfully recite banded birds?
It's questionable. So the story goes that he one spring found some baby, I want to say it was phoebes. It was one of the flycatchers. It was phoebes or eastern pewees, one of those. Found like a nest of phoebes on his property and tied silver thread to the feet of the baby nestlings. And that then the next spring, an adult phoebe showed back up on his property and it had his silver thread still around its foot. And so he was, you know, he's sometimes credited as the father of bird banding for this reason, even though, you know, he was using thread, but whatever. But there's actually really good evidence that second spring, when he says that he saw a phoebe with a silver thread on it come back to this property that he had done this on, he was, I believe, I'm trying to remember, in France. He was like not there. So there's no way that he could have recited this bird. And also site fidelity, like the chances that a bird is going to come back to the very same spot that it fledged at varies from species to species. Site fidelity is not that high in this particular species. So the chances that one of those fledglings would have like turned up on the same porch the next spring, like that doesn't actually make any sense for that species of bird. So people now are thinking, like he might have actually put silver threads on baby birds' feet, but the idea that he recited one the next spring, he might have just made up just to make it into a better story.
Like, cool story, bro. Cool.
Yeah, that's not the only time that there's evidence that Audubon has kind of embellished things to make himself sound cooler than he really was.
But the most exciting thing to me about bird banding is that in many of the ways that scientists study migration now, they never touch the birds at all. Like, you know, you can do like radar and like, you know, various kinds of sighting of birds where you never actually touch a bird. But for banding, you got to catch a bird. And nowadays, most of the time that's done with things called mist nets. And you've done a little bit of this. And I was wondering if you could talk about how it works and what you do.
I have not done enough mist netting to be able to do it independently. Like I never had a banding permit of my own, but I have earlier in my career helped out at some banding stations. So yeah, they take these nets called mist nets that are sort of like a badminton net or something. It's like a long net strung between two poles, but it's made of this very, very fine thread. So it's very difficult to see against like the backdrop of vegetation, especially if you're a bird. And they have these like taut horizontal lines. I'm gesturing as though podcast listeners can see me. They have these like taut horizontal lines. And then in between those are kind of like baggier sections of nets. And so the way this works is that if a bird flies into it, it kind of drops down and gets caught in like a pocket, like between these horizontal sections, if that makes sense. I'm trying to describe. It's easier to see. It's easier to understand if you could see a picture, but hopefully that makes sense. When the birds get pretty well tangled up, they can be hard to extract from the mist net. I never got very good at that because it takes a lot of practice to figure out how to like gently get all these loops of net off of their head and off of their feet. Woodpeckers are really difficult because woodpeckers have really long tongues and they will sometimes get excited and stick out their tongue and their tongue gets tangled in the net.
Oh, no.
I am making this sound really unpleasant for the bird, but actually the percentage of birds that get injured by this is very tiny. You'd be surprised. Most birds are completely unharmed by this experience. And if that were not the case, people wouldn't do it. And you have to have all sorts of training to get a permit to do this yourself. You can't just decide that you want to put up mist nets in the woods. So yeah, they carefully extract the bird, they take it out, and then they carry it back to their work area, which is where they do the weighing and the measuring and the actual attachment of the band.
I would actually give a lot of money to see a photo of a woodpecker with its tongue in a mist net.
If you do a Google image search for woodpecker tongue in mist net, you can probably find the picture.
Oh, no. Okay. That's what I'm doing later. So one of the things I really love about bird banding is how many people see these banded birds, and sometimes they even shoot them, like they are hunting and they hunt the bird, mm-hmm. and then they report them because the bands have an address. And like, it used to be a mailing address, and then it was like a phone number, and then it was like a website. And I was wondering, was there ever a process to like educate the public on this? Because I feel like there's not a lot of space on one of these bands. So it's just going to be like name, address. And I feel like it'd be easy to like shoot a banded bird and then be like, oh no, this was someone's bird. I'm just going to hide this and pretend it never happened. Like, do people ever worry they've done something wrong? And how do you like encourage people to report the banded bird?
Well, so when you're talking about hunters aren't out going after little songbirds. Most of So a lot of bird banding happens with ducks, with waterfowl. And so
for waterfowl, basically.
Yes. And it's actually part of hunter education. Like if you want to be a duck hunter, I think that's part of the process is learning about banded birds, because it's part of how they collect information on population sizes to kind of set hunting limits and everything is by looking at band reports. And so there's definitely a big program to educate duck hunters about this in particular. And you mentioned that waterfowl, that ducks have one of the highest, you know, return rates for these bands. And that is because there are hunters out shooting the birds and who know to look for bands. They actually even do like reward bands where when this is specific to ducks, but some small percentage of the bands that they put out have some sort of special code on them where if you report that band, you get like a cash reward. So to encourage hunters to be on the lookout for bands and to report them. So waterfowl banding is kind of its own special world that works a little bit differently from songbird banding, even though the data that we get from it is similar and it's still overseen by the same government body. But there's a lot more because it's a game species and we need to be able to have population estimates to set hunting limits and things like that. There's a lot more that goes into waterfowl banding.
So I will admit there's one part of the book that actually completely blew my mind. I had no idea that a huge number of birds migrated at night, which yes. is understandable. I am, of course, asleep, but I had no clue that they were doing these huge migrations at night. And I think it's because we often think when we think of bird migration, probably for many of us, the only migration we've ever seen is like a V of geese.
Yeah.
You know, kind of wheeling through the sky, or, you know, a huge murmuration of starlings, something like that. But it turns out a whole bunch of birds migrate at night. And why do they do that?
Yeah. So it's a lot of it is the songbirds. So again, like waterfowl and songbirds, kind of two different migratory things going on there. So your little songbirds, yeah, most of them migrate at night. There's a number of reasons for this. One of them is that the atmosphere is calmer. So you don't have the sun creating thermals, creating turbulence in the air. So it's just easier flying. There's also fewer predators out and about, like looking for it to snack on a bird at night. So yeah, there's several reasons why it's just easier and safer for them to move at night.
That's amazing. Also, are there any like raptors or, you know, predators that just sit there in a tree with their mouth open waiting?
Not that I could think of off the top of my head, but I wouldn't be surprised if that exists somewhere in the world.
And I was also really struck because you mentioned in the book that the birds are not staying out late and flying late. They're not getting up very early and flying early. They are waking up in the middle of the night and migrating in the middle of the night. So it's not just a drive to actually travel. Migration also changes the circadian rhythms of these birds. Like, they're not setting alarm clocks to get up and migrate at 1 o'clock in the morning. They are explicitly staying up all night.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'm not sure if that's kind of where we've landed now, but that was one of the things that was an ongoing debate when they were doing like nocturnal flight call monitoring, which is where they were putting out microphones to record birds going overhead versus moonwatching. They kind of got different patterns as far, well, moonwatching, we haven't got to that one yet. Basically, depending on which of these early methods you used to see what was going on with migrating birds over the course of the night, you got different numbers. And I'm not sure that that bit about getting up in the middle of the night to do their migration then has necessarily been borne out, or it might vary from species to species. But yeah, it is interesting that they are active at night to make progress at night. And then during the day, they settle down to eat and rest and refuel.
And so we started talking a little bit. I'd like to hear more about the acoustic monitoring, because I always think, oh, well, if you're flying at night, you must fly silently so that you can be like secretive. But that's not true. You can actually record the calls of birds as they are migrating at night.
Yes, and anyone can do this. So birds, these night migrating songbirds, a lot of them have what are called nocturnal flight calls, which are these special calls that they make while they're migrating at night that in a lot of cases are different from calls that they make at any other time. If you're about to ask me why they do this is another one of those cases where it's like, well, we're still figuring that out. But there was this really cool study a few years ago that looked specifically at warblers, which is one family of migratory songbirds, and looked at their nocturnal flight calls. And they found that regardless of how closely related in specific species of warblers were, they were likely to have more similar nocturnal flight calls if they followed more similar migratory routes, suggesting that it might be a way that they like find and stick with other birds kind of heading in a similar direction, which is really cool that it might have this social function. But we don't really know for sure. We're still figuring this out. And so, yeah, they're making these flight calls. And because of this, one thing that you can do if you want to monitor migration is just put out microphones to pick these up. And you need some sort of like bucket or something to put your microphone down in to amplify the sounds, because they can be kind of quiet, but you can automate this. You can then just leave microphones out there. The problem is that then you have like 8 hours of recording to go through. And so now they're working on like machine learning tools that can pick out and identify the calls within that. But yeah, this is an area that's, I think, still has a lot more potential that hasn't been explored yet, because some of those machine learning tools are still in their infancy. Of course, the first folks to record these calls didn't have digital recorders at all. They were using tape recorders. And this was back in the 50s. They figured out how to rig up a tape recorder with a bicycle axle to hold 6,000 feet of tape so that they could record an eight-hour night. But yeah, this is one of the many, many ways that people have developed to figure out what birds are up to when they're migrating.
I think one of my favorite anecdotes from your book is they were putting little microphones in buckets, and they had to put a little perch outside the bucket because otherwise, like, this baby owl would sit inside the bucket all night and ruin the recording.
I don't think it was sitting inside the bucket. It was like sitting on top of the post that they had their microphone on or something like that. But yeah, these are these folks out in Montana that have had this project, this thing called, they've called it Project Night Flight, where they had this array of microphones to kind of track bird migration through the Bitterroot Valley in Montana. And yeah, they would have juvenile great horned owls like perching on top of their microphones, calling and calling all night. And so they finally had to like provide a different perch next to it for the owl that was nicer to stop the owl from just sitting on top of their recording equipment all night.
And they're like baby owls. I just love that it's like, you know, a bunch of like derpy tween owls.
Yes.
Out there ruining a scientist's evening.
Yes.
It makes me very happy. But you mentioned, you know, they are trying to, you know, get machine learning tools, understand and categorize these many, 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 many calls.
Yeah.
And I was actually wondering that it seems like something that we should already have. I feel like because you can narrow something down to a sound wave pattern, and then you can just compare the little sound wave patterns against each other. And I was wondering why is it taking so long to develop that? Like, is there a bottleneck in terms of like the number of recordings people can get or identification of the call, like that sort of thing?
I mean, I think it's just that AI machine learning technology has been advancing pretty quickly. So it's only fairly recently that we've got computers that could really do that stuff. And so there's two problems with this. The first one is just if you have 8 hours of recordings, you need to know like what are the timestamps where there is a call that might be of interest. So the first, you know, step that you want to automate and computerize is just like picking out the calls, like not even identifying them to species, but just like where in this 8 hours of tape are there calls. And then the second problem is identifying them. And so they're working on automating both of those steps. And obviously I think the first one is probably easier to automate than the second one, but yeah. And they're getting there now. Like this pretty much does exist now, but it's new within the last maybe 10 years that this has really become practical.
And I also was really interested because scientists do not always rely on sound. They also figured out that you can stare at the moon really hard and you can spot birds as they fly in front of the moon. And I love this. And you have tried this.
It did not go well, but yes.
I was wondering, can you talk through like what it's like? What do you have to do? You know, how closely are you staring at this moon?
Yeah. So yeah, I mentioned the word moonwatching earlier and then was like, wait, we haven't talked about that yet. So because birds migrate at night, another thing they figured out pretty early on was that you could point a telescope at the full moon during bird migration and see the silhouettes of birds passing in front of it. And in the 40s and 50s, this ornithologist in Louisiana named George Lowry kind of took this a step further and came up with some math that would let him kind of standardize this as a measurement that he could compare it from place to place so that he could see how much migration was like, what was the volume of migration at one place in time versus the volume of migration at another place in time. So it was one of the first tools for really being able to do that. And he did some really cool stuff with it before weather radar came along and basically made all the work he put into this obsolete. But I did try this when I was working on the book. I borrowed a telescope. I set it up in my driveway. I pointed it at the moon. I did it for, I don't remember how long I sat out there for. I saw one thing that I thought maybe might have been a bird. There was like a little flicker of something, although it also could have been a satellite, which is not something that folks doing this in the 40s. Yeah. Or a bat, like, or an insect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like there's all sorts of like different distances that this little flickering thing in front of the moon could have been at. It's possible that I was just not doing it on a good night because there's even during migration season, you know, the amount of migration happening on varies from night to night with the weather. But yeah, it was actually, the moon is very bright. And so just like staring at the full moon through a telescope for any length of time, especially the telescope that I had was not well suited to this because I had to like crane my neck to look down through the eyepiece. And it was very uncomfortable. I'm glad that I was not a researcher using this technique in like the 50s. Spending hours and hours staring at the moon through a telescope trying to count birds. It probably was not actually that fun.
We talked a little bit about how methods sections are amazing. And the methods section of like this citizen's guide to watching birds by watching the moon includes a whole section on how to arrange your lawn chair
yes.
so that you're not miserable.
Yes. And I did not follow that advice because I didn't have a telescope that was configured the right way. But it was, yes, like, arrange a lawn chair that you can just like lie in and then like look upward into the telescope. And there was this amazing figure in the how-to pamphlet that the guys doing this and recruiting volunteers to do this in the 40s and 50s, they had this illustration of like a guy in like leisure pants with a cigar, like a line drawing, like lying down to look up through the telescope. And like, I don't know if it was meant to be funny or not. Like, why does he have a cigar? It was the 50s. I don't know. It was strange.
That's amazing. Yeah. And of course, as we mentioned, one of the biggest advances that helps to study bird migration was the use of radar.
Yes.
And it started with war, because the number of technical advances that have started with the military is not zero. And they started calling what they were seeing angels.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could talk about what they were seeing and why they decided to call them angels.
Yeah. So the first real application of radar was during World War II. So England, they built this network of radar stations all along the coast, looking out over the English Channel as an early warning system for any like Nazi planes headed toward England. But pretty much as soon as these things were in operation, they started seeing weird signals on them that were not planes. Like planes, they kind of plod along at a consistent speed and trajectory, and they started seeing these other weird things that would appear and disappear and change speed and change direction at random, and they couldn't figure out what they were looking at. This might be apocryphal, but supposedly at one point they even like urgently scrambled fighter planes into the air to go intercept strange signals over the English Channel, got out there and there was nothing there. And so the radar operators started calling these things radar angels because they just couldn't figure out what they were. And of course, because we're talking about bird migration, where this is going is that they were actually birds, but it took them a while to figure that out.
That's amazing to me. It also makes me wonder how many like UFOs that people see are actually birds.
I would not be surprised.
And also, I was amazed to learn that weather radar to this day has to account for birds. Like there's a cleaning process for birds.
Yes. If you turn on the Weather Channel in May and it's nighttime and you're looking to see, you know, if there's a thunderstorm in your area and you see a weather radar image, they are doing something on a computer to remove any distractions like migrating birds from that, because migrating birds show up really, really well on weather radar. And they like filter all of that out of the radar images that they use for weather forecasting on TV.
I love that. Otherwise, apparently it looks like you're always going to have light rain during times.
Yeah. Well, if you look at like an unfiltered map of the whole, you know, whole US with all the radar stations during migration, you just see these like round green blobs up and down the continent. And the reason of that is that each of those round blobs is the field of view of one individual radar station. And as the birds just lift off in the evening to begin their night's migration, there's so many of them that they can just, you know, in an area where there's happens to be a big migratory movement that night, they just can saturate the entire field of view of each radar station as they lift off. It's pretty incredible.
Cloudy with a chance of birds.
Yes.
And of course, birds that are migrating at night can get into trouble, especially because our cities are very bright. We don't know why they are attracted to the light, but they seek the light. And so I love that people are now tracking birds and try to predict kind of when birds are going to appear in a place so that people can turn their lights off, which I love. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Project Birdcast.
Yeah.
And how it works.
Yeah. So migrating birds are attracted to artificial light at night. As you said, we don't really know why. When I was writing the chapter that covers this, I realized like, oh, I should probably explain why this is. And I emailed one of these researchers that I interviewed being like, wait, why do birds do this? And he was like, we don't know. So they're still working on that one. But yeah, the birds are attracted to artificial light at night, which means they fly into cities and they get disoriented. They often collide with buildings and they can die. So this is one of these sources of mortality on bird migration. And so a really simple, really helpful thing would just be to turn out those lights. But it might be hard to persuade the managers of all the skyscrapers in, you know, downtown Houston, which is the classic example of a city that's in an important migratory flyway, to shut off their lights for the entire month of May. So instead, what they're doing is using radar data, they have found that they can predict a couple days in advance when these big migratory flights are going to occur. Because I said, even during migration, there's not a lot of birds in the sky every night. It depends a lot on what's going on with the weather. So by having done some like big data analysis, looking at decades of radar scans and weather patterns, they figured out how to predict, like, is this night going to be a big night or not? And so now with Birdcast, first of all, any bird watcher can get on and see these forecasts of like, okay, is tomorrow morning going to be a really good day to go bird watching in my area? Because a lot of birds will have passed through. So Birdcast is a website that anyone can get on. But the other part of what they're doing with Birdcast is these lights out alerts where they're like, okay, Houston, tomorrow night is going to be a really big night for migration and people should turn off their lights. The question, and I think, you know, getting buy-in on this from the people who manage these buildings is an ongoing process, but it is happening over time. And so this is one way that we can help out migratory birds is just by creating a darker environment for them on nights when there are a lot of them traveling.
And of course, there are several other ways to track bird movements, radio transmitters, now GPS. And I was actually completely unprepared for just how tiny these transmitters need to be. It's mentioned that the original guess was like it needed to be about 5% of a bird's body weight. But now scientists are worried that that's actually not light enough. And I love that you spoke with an ethicist about this. You talked to Bill Lynn, who I have spoken to as well.
Oh, really?
And I was interested in this because, you know, it seems like putting a tracking device on a bird seems like the most harmless thing that you could do to the bird. But that's not necessarily true. And I was wondering, how do scientists and how do ethicists kind of weigh the pros and cons of tracking a bird?
Yeah. So, yeah, we're switching gears here and sort of moving from these passive ways of seeing what's going on with birds with like moon watching and radar and recordings and to these active things where you're putting some sort of backpack on a bird that's going to record its movements. And there are a lot of different kinds of tracking backpacks, but there's a number of different devices where it all basically boils down to you're putting a thing on a bird that that bird is then going to carry on its body somewhere while it goes on migration. And so they try to make them as tiny as possible relative to the weight of the bird. You mentioned the 5% rule, which wasn't really based on any data. It was just sort of a rule of thumb that someone made up back when this stuff was going. And now some people try to aim for 3%, which is where the weight of the transmitter or the device shouldn't be more than 5% or 3% or what have you of the total body weight of the bird. And they don't typically they don't cause a whole lot of harm, but they do add weight. And so the way to think about this is that the smaller it is, you know, the less effect it has on the bird. There's other ways that it, you know, there's other ways that these things might affect birds. You can get that effect to be very small. You can't get it to zero. There's no device that you can put on a bird that's not going to affect the bird's life in some way, even if it's just like the bird's going to spend some extra time preening because it can feel this weird thing in its feathers. And so you have to decide how much potential harm are you okay with, considered in relation to the data that you're going to get from this and what you might do from that data. And so I think the argument is that even if there might be some hopefully quite small potential harm to a couple individual birds that are wearing these devices, and to be clear, often that harm is not large. These birds are going on with their lives. They're migrating successfully. They're having babies. It's not like you put a tracker on a bird, it's going to go out there and die. That's not usually what happens. But you have to decide how much risk of harm are you okay with. And I got sidetracked for a second there, but I think where a lot of people land and where I land is that often the data that's being collected can inform conservation efforts that can be beneficial for an entire population or an entire species. So it's this idea that like the good of the many outweighs the good of the few. Like we're creating some small potential negative effect for a few birds, and in return, we're hopefully going to benefit their entire species. And yeah, when I was coming to the end of the sort of section of the book that deals with all these tracking devices, I knew that there were going to be some people reading the book and feeling uncomfortable with this of like, does it hurt the birds? Because every time I post a photo on social media of like someone handling a bird and putting a band on it or someone's going to comment and be like, oh, why, you know, that poor bird, why are they doing that to that poor bird? So yeah. So I realized that I kind of needed to address the ethics of this because people are understandably going to be wondering about that. And I started out by talking to a couple ornithologists who had done large reviews of, you know, the harms or lack thereof that these devices can cause. And then, as you said, I actually ended up talking to a philosopher. It's amazing how useful Twitter can be for research. And I was doing this before all of the horrible stuff that's happened with Twitter in the last year or so, but I literally just put on Twitter, like, who is an ethicist who could talk me through like whether or not it's ethical to put these tracking devices on birds. And someone saw this and suggested that I talk to Bill Lynn, who you mentioned, who is a philosopher, but who has done stuff like consulting on the Fish and Wildlife Service plan to cull barred owls to protect spotted owls. So he's like a philosopher and ethicist of ornithology. And I was like, all right, perfect. So yeah, we got on the phone and we talked through these ethical questions. And as I said, I think I land on that it is ethically acceptable to do this as long as you're doing everything you can to minimize the harm to the bird and doing everything you can to make really good use of the data that you're getting in return. That was a long rambly answer. I'm sorry.
No, I think it's really important. And I also wanted to make sure that we got in yours and my favorite method of tracking, which is the ability to track where birds have been through their feathers and deuterium, heavy hydrogens.
Yes.
Which makes me so happy. And I was wondering if you could talk about how heavy hydrogens work.
Yes. No one knows about this. And it's so cool. So everyone has heard of hydrogen. It's this really common element, but some small proportion of hydrogen atoms are heavier than the normal ones. They have a neutron in their nucleus, which makes them heavier. And they're not radioactive, like they're not harmful, they're very stable, but they just exist out there. Some small percentage of hydrogen atoms are weird. And so when they get incorporated into water molecules, you know, they can form water molecules just like regular hydrogen atoms can. And then you get heavy water, which you talked about, because again, they're heavier than normal hydrogen atoms. And we can use this. This is what's called isotopes, by the way, is when you have variations on an element that have different weights.
And people might be familiar with this mostly from like radiocarbon dating.
For example, when you're
dealing with like carbon 14 degrading to carbon 13 over time.
Yes. And so that's radioactive decay. That is an isotope that is radioactive and changes over time. And so deuterium is what we call a stable isotope, where it's not radioactive. It does not decay. It just sits there. But what's kind of cool is where you can use radiocarbon dating to sort of locate something in time and see how old it is. Ornithologists have figured out how to use these stable isotopes to locate something in space and figure out where in the landscape a bird came from. Because how much deuterium there is in the environment varies from place to place across the landscape in a predictable way. In North America, there's this very nice latitudinal gradient where the further north you get, the less of it there is out there. And this has to do with like moisture being picked up in the ocean and coming inland across the continent, and the heavier stuff tends to fall out of the clouds as rain first. And so birds molt and regrow their feathers every year. And when they're in a place working on regrowing their feathers and they're eating and drinking, whatever the percentage of hydrogen is in that particular place that's actually deuterium, this weird heavy hydrogen, that's the percentage of hydrogen atoms that end up in their feathers that are deuterium. And feathers are inert. So once that feather is grown, it doesn't change over the course of the year. Like that amount of deuterium is just locked in there until that feather is molted. And so after this bird takes off and flies somewhere else, you can pluck a feather, run it through some big machines to see what percentage of the hydrogen in that feather is actually deuterium, and get a rough idea of where the bird must have been when it grew that feather.
I love
and
that
you can
so
do
much.
This with other elements too. It's not just hydrogen. There's other stable isotopes for yeah that have
that actually makes
variation.
Me wonder though. You know, for birds that rely on human provided food sources, right? Like bird seed does not come from local areas, and so I was wondering, like maybe it screws with the deuterium mapping. Like if you get a bunch of birds that have been heavily relying on human subsistence food.
That is a really good question. I have never heard of anyone studying that.
It'd be cool.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. I think it's possible that even for birds that visit bird feeders, it's not a large enough part of their diet for it to really make a difference. So I don't know.
It'd be really interesting. You probably tell by like looking at pigeons, you know, because pigeons don't migrate. And then like, look at like the amount of, you know, those that are feeding on very, very local, like human trash, and those that are feeding heavily on birdseed, and see if you see any difference. It might be interesting.
Yeah, that would be an interesting study for someone to do.
So one of the most important things that tracking birds can teach us is where and when we need to actually change our conservation efforts. And I was wondering if you could talk about what scientists do with the information they get from these migratory studies.
So these studies are useful because they can help us really pinpoint conservation efforts to make them as effective as possible. If you've got a migratory bird species or a population within a species, because a lot of these species have different populations that have slightly different migratory behavior, and that population is declining, its numbers are going down, you don't know right away whether that's due to some problem in its breeding range or in its wintering range or with a stopover site that they rely on during migration or more than one of those. So you have to have, like, step one of figuring this out is just knowing where those locations are. So you have to have really detailed data on where exactly these birds are going at every time of year so that you can look at what is happening in each of those places to try and figure out what are the specific problems that you need to solve.
And I was also interested that, you know, there is the opportunity to do that. There's the opportunity to figure out where and when to intervene. But you noted, actually, there aren't very many success stories kind of based on this data. And I was wondering why that is the case.
Yeah, that's a really good question. When I was writing the conclusion for the book, my first thought was, okay, well, I'm going to go look for these stories of where new tracking data has led directly to some new effective conservation effort. There are examples out there. There are some really cool examples out there. There's one with the Swainson's hawk, where Swainson's hawks in the Western US were declining and no one knew why. And they put satellite trackers on them and figured out that the problem was a pesticide being used in South America, and were able to put an agreement in place to limit use of this pesticide. but I didn't find as many of these stories as I thought that I would. And I think that might largely be, or at least in part be, because getting down to this level of detail for individual populations is still pretty new. And we still just don't have this amount of information for a lot of migratory bird species. So it's still, we're still working on it. And then the second part of this is also just that there's a long process to get from, okay, we have this data on exactly where this bird goes. Like I said, that's step one. Then you need to sort of check out each of these places and investigate for possible threats that might be happening. And then you need to work with local landowners or local governments to mitigate that threat. So having this tracking data is an important prerequisite for being able to do this work, but it's the beginning, it's not the end, if that makes sense. So you have to get this data from scientific journals out to people who are like on the ground conservation practitioners, and then you have to convince policymakers. And so it's a whole lengthy process.
But one of the things that is my probably favorite thing about bird studies in general, but migration in particular, is that the field really encourages and relies on citizen science or community science. You know, there's so many studies that, you know, really say, okay, we need like 10,000 people to go outside with binoculars now.
Yeah.
And do a thing. And I just really love that. And I was wondering, why do you think this particular field is especially well suited for kind of involving communities?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's true. Yeah, I think a lot of fields of science have tried to sort of get these citizen science or community science type projects off the ground where they're recruiting people to volunteer to help out with these research projects in some way. But I cannot think of any other branch of science besides ornithology, the study of birds, that has this equivalent hobbyist population that is so large and so passionate. I mean, certainly there are people who are really like, who without being professional scientists are really into native plants or really into insects. You know, those people exist, but not quite on the same level as bird watchers, where this is just a recognized hobby that everyone has heard of and everyone knows someone who does it. And so this has been the case all along with the history of ornithology. Early in the history of ornithology, there wasn't a lot of distinction between an amateur birder and a professional ornithologist. And there were plenty of people who had a day job as, you know, a lawyer or a doctor or something back in the 19th century, and then might go out and collect data on the birds in their area in the weekend and write that up and have it be published in a scientific journal. And so even as ornithology as a profession has become, you know, more professionalized, you have to have a PhD to kind of lead a lot of this research, there's still the whole time been this parallel group of passionate amateur hobbyists. And so citizen science or community science has been a thing in ornithology for longer than those words have existed. There's been community science projects in ornithology going back to the early 20th century, like the Christmas bird count, where people go out every winter to count all the birds that they can see in their area. And that's still going on now. And now we have these tools like eBird, which is an online platform where birders can submit their data to. And eBird, like the database of eBird sightings of like data that just amateur birders have contributed to this is huge and is being used by professional ornithologists now for really cool, innovative ways. So it is really inspiring that we have this huge skilled pool of people who are passionate about birds and who are going out and looking at birds and are willing to contribute that data. And it lets us do some really, really cool things.
And another thread that kind of runs through the book, unfortunately, is how climate change and habitat loss are affecting migrating bird populations, really all birds. And I was wondering, are there overall trends for how climate change is affecting migrating species in particular?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I mentioned that because of long-term bird banding data, we can see how the timing of migration has been changing over time. I think a lot of the scientists who have done this analysis would be quick to say, well, we don't know for sure that that's caused by climate change. You know, it's correlation, but it's hard to get from correlation to causation. But I think most lay people looking at this and seeing like, oh, spring migration has gotten several days early over the past couple of decades, like, I bet I have a good guess as to why. You know, like it makes sense that that's probably related to climate change. As to whether climate change so far is causing significant population declines in migrating birds, I think the scientists who are working on this would say not yet. At least at this point, it is not the main factor. So there was this paper that came out a few years ago that got a lot of publicity that was called the 3 billion birds paper. And this wasn't looking
just... Pete Mara was the author on that one.
Yeah, he was one of them. Yeah, it had a long list of authors. Ken Rosenthal, also a bunch of people. But this was not just looking at migratory birds. It was looking at all birds in North America. But they drew from a bunch of data sources and found that there are about 3 billion with a B fewer birds living in North America now than there were in 1970, which is almost a 30% decline. It's just staggering. And so they went through... what are the likely causes of this? And climate change is not really on the list. The things that have been causing these declines, like looking back over the last few decades, are primarily habitat loss. And then after habitat loss, you get into things like window collisions, which we sort of touched on with the artificial lights. Cats are actually on that list. A lot of people don't want to hear this, but outdoor cats are actually a large source of mortality for migrating birds, like significant enough that it shows up in the data, and then pesticides and things like that. So if you look at like the trends that we have data so far, where you're looking at what's been going on in the last couple decades, climate change probably doesn't really rise to the top as far as something that's causing declines that we can already see. I think if you look ahead and try to guess what's going to happen in the next few decades, that's going to shift and you'll see climate change rising up that list of things that are driving the numbers.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for being here and for telling us a lot of stuff about where all the birds go.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This has been fun.
If you'd like to learn more about Rebecca Heisman and her book, Flight Paths, How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solved the Mystery of Bird Migration, we've got links for you at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, you have many options available to you. You could subscribe to the show if you haven't already. You could leave us a kind review or follow us on social media. If you're feeling especially enthusiastic, you could support us on our Patreon with a monthly or one-time donation to help keep the show going. No matter what you choose, we're glad you're here. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People.
Science for the People is listener supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.